where's the global economy heading? The last couple of centuries have seen an enormous explosion of material wealth around the world, but it's distributed unevenly, and poverty remains a stubborn problem in vast regions. How we got here and how we can steer towards a fairer future is the subject of the new book, Slouching Towards Utopia, An Economic History of the 20th Century, an instant bestseller from J. Bradford DeLong. Brad is an economic historian who teaches at UC Berkeley. He was a deputy assistant secretary of the U.S. Treasury in the Clinton administration and writes a popular blog on Substack. He joins us now to share five big ideas from this long-awaited book.
Let's start with the metaphor of the economic pie. First, you have to bake a big enough pie. Then you have to slice it so that people have enough. Then you have to taste it. People have to enjoy it. People have to use their wealth, their power to manipulate nature and to command the attention and assistance of others. That really is what wealth is, to live lives in which they feel safe and secure and are healthy and happy. Again, start with the metaphor of the economic pie, baking, slicing, and tasting. Before 1870, we humans simply could not bake a big enough pie. By 2010, we could. That solved the problem of baking. That ought, according to the thinking of those living in earlier ages, have solved the problem of building utopia, because the problems of slicing and tasting should then have been easier to deal. Most non-utopian features of human societies had, after all, been a consequence of there not being enough for everyone. To have enough for yourself, therefore, meant figuring out a way to dominate others and appropriate their work. Thus, from one perspective, my book is about how we solved the problem of baking the pie, but then somehow how between 1870 and 2010 we fumbled the solution to the problems of slicing and tasting. That is the big narrative sweep of the book, admittedly with lots of subthreads, digressions, and anecdotes along the way. Back in the Industrial Revolution century, 1770 to 1870, the proportional rate of growth of technology deployed and diffused into the world economy was less than 0.5% per year worldwide. That is slow enough that a population growth rate of 0.9% per year would neutralize any impact on better technology and average incomes. And in even a poor world, population could easily grow at 0.9% per year, doubling every three generations, and so keep humanity at a stagnant level and thus never get rich enough to trigger the fertility decline and the demographic transition which have put us on the path to a stable world population of 10 billion or so by 2050 and allowed us room to use our technology to make us vastly richer. That was how history worked before 1870. And before the 1770 to 1870 Industrial Revolution century, things were considerably even worse. Technology growth rates of 0.15% per year worldwide over 1500 to 1770 and less before. But we got a big shift. We got a crossing of a watershed boundary around 1870, with the coming of the Industrial Research Lab, the modern corporation, and full globalization. The average rate of growth of technology deployed and diffused worldwide rapidly jumped up from less than 0.5% per year to more than 2% per year, where it stayed until at least 2010. From a doubling time of 160 years, with practically all increases in technological prowess eaten up by the resource scarcity produced by a rising population, to a doubling time of 34 years. Every generation, technology twice as effective as it had been before. Malthusian population growth could not keep up. Thus, after 1870, the problem of baking a big enough pie was on track to being solved. Its solution was straightforward: just let the market economy rip. Let the industrial research labs and the corporations do their thing in the context of the global market economy. Previously unimaginable economic growth would revolutionize human life, did so every generation, and did so over and over. So how should we answer our predecessors, who would look at the extraordinary and amazing technological power of our civilization and say, why have you not created a utopia, since you have solved the problem of enough? What happened? Well, my book says that letting the market economy rip, that had consequences. The repeated, sequential, Schumpeterian, creative destruction economic revolutions, they meant that all that was solid melted into air, that all established patterns and orders were steamed away. Men and women did have to try to build new institutions to manage the problems and opportunities of production, distribution, and utilization that the ongoing technological cornucopia brought. Now, that idiot Friedrich von Hayek had thought that the unleashed market would do the whole job. The market would produce enough. True, the market could not produce social justice, but we dare not ask for social justice. Why not? Because attempting to achieve it would undermine the market's ability to do what it could. It would put us on, well, the road to serfdom. The market giveth, the market taketh away. Blessed be the name of the market. That was the gospel preached by Friedrich von Hayek, and he thought that was our only gospel. But as that genius Karl Polanyi put it in his book, The Great Transformation, the stark utopia of von Hayek's catalaxy was unsustainable. People simply would not stand for being told that there were no rights but property rights. They would insist instead that the market was made for man, not man for the market. The market's treating those whom society saw as equals unequally or unequals equally brought social explosion after explosion, blocking the road to utopia as people saw themselves as deserving communities, incomes, and stability. They needed their Polanyian rights to economic security, to an income level proportional to what they deserved, and that other people should have income levels proportional to what they deserved, too. They deserved all this in a connected society that gave them respect and place, plus that you should have some power and voice in society, even if you had no wealth. Trying to bring about the stark utopia of market society, it faced explosions. It was overwhelmed by social political movements that did indeed seek social justice, which might be a very inegalitarian kind of social justice, because it would give people not equal shares, but rather what those making the rules deserve. Thus, the book wound up with the Polanyian left neoliberal grand narrative that I have just outlined, that Friedrich von Hayek was a genius in understanding how powerful the market economy could be in allowing the crowdsourcing of the solution to the problems of making enough. The increase in technology allowed the economy to consider those problems, and the market economy as the most efficient crowdsourcing mechanism alive. Once technology had unlocked the lock, the market economy could crowdsource the solution to the problem of baking enough. But how about the other problems? Well, since 1870, humans, Theodore Roosevelt, Benito Mussolini, Deng Xiaoping, Margaret Thatcher, others, many others, tried to think up solutions. They dissented from the market giveth constructively and destructively. They demanded the market do less or different and other institutions do more. John Maynard Keynes whimpered that if only governments allowed his technocratic students to conduct sensible monetary policy, along with a somewhat comprehensive socialization of investment, then everyone would have a job and thus some social power. And technology plus compound interest would wreak marvels, and rock-bottom interest rates would euthanize rentiers, so that plutocrats could use their money's social power only at the cost of spending it down their capital and so relinquishing it. Thus, in the not very long run, Keynes whimpered, Keynesian technocrats could solve the problems of production and distribution, leaving humanity to grapple with its real permanent problem, that of utilizing our wealth to create a truly human world. And perhaps humanity did indeed come close to an institutional societal setup to tackle the problems of slicing and tasting. Social democracy, Keynesianism, the New Deal order in the rich countries after World War II, I think it was a good try, but somehow social democracy failed its sustainability test, was unpopular, was replaced by vote of the people, by neoliberalism, which stubbornly persists in spite of its failure to fulfill its promises. Except its promise it would make the rich much richer and with much rich social power. Society may not know what social justice is, but it knows it manifestly does not consist of giving benefits to and making life easy for those it assesses as undeserving. And the New Deal order was in the end judged as giving too much to those assessed as undeserving, and so the wheel turned. Here we are. Why are not the good people of the global north, at least, happier and more satisfied with the techno-utopian marvels that have been delivered to them? Why has great wealth in historical perspective produced not reduced but increased economic anxiety? And how does that economic anxiety get transformed into ethno-nationalist fear and rage? And how is it that the neoliberal ordering of society still survives, given that it has fulfilled exactly none of the promises made by its original salesmen except that of making the rich richer? Our current situation? In the rich countries, there is enough by any reasonable standard. Yet we're all unhappy, all earnestly seeking to discover who the enemies are who have somehow stolen our rich birthright and fed us unappetizing lentil stew instead. The story of how all that happened from 1870 to 2010, that's the story of my book. What do we do next? Well, that my book punts. That is for a younger generation than my largely failed one to decide. Global warming, ethno-nationalist terrorism on all scales from the individual AR-15 to the combined arms army, revived fascism, killer robots stalking the skies looking for people to kill, techno-kleptocracy, I do quail. As John Maynard Keynes wrote back in 1924 in an earlier crisis of the world capitalist system, wondering but not knowing what to do next, thinking that we know what the next step is, quote, assumes a plan exists, but we lack much more than usual a coherent scheme of progress, a tangible ideal. All the political parties alike have their origins in past ideas and not in new ideas. No one has a gospel. The next move is with the head, unquote. Keynes was right in 1924. Keynes is right today.
Thank you, Brad. That was Jay Bradford DeLong with five big ideas from Slouching Towards Utopia, An Economic History of the 20th Century. If you'd like a contrasting point of view, check out our book bite for The Tragic Science, How Economists Cause Harm, Even as They Aspire to Do Good, by George DeMartino. I'm Rufus Griscom. Have an amazing day.